I've known Phil Terone for a long time. He's the Godzilla of gadgets. He's the czar of crap. The king of bling. So every little shiny thing that comes by, he gets, he tries out, he breaks, he takes it apart and fixes it in new and interesting ways and documents it up on Make. He's the senior editor at Make magazine. And he's in the interesting position today of being the marketing fluff, where he's not the technical one of the two people who are coming up here today. The technical one is Lemoore Freed, who is, and I'm going to throw this out there and you can come up and correct us later, but I'm going to say that she's the only person actually making money from an open source hardware company today. So if you'd like to make them very welcome, they're going to come and give you an hour of, now 54 minutes and 31 seconds, of fantastic open source hardware and show us the world that is coming into being here that we didn't really realize was happening, where these things that we do in open source are being applied to the real world and other aspects. So please make them welcome, Phil and Lemoore.
All right. Take that. All right, everyone, a round of applause for Nat. I mean, come on. Here. 11 years of doing this. Woo! All right, Phil Terone, senior editor of Fluff, I guess now. This is a good title.
Fluff magazine.
Of Fluff magazine now.
Owner of Adafruit Industries, which is a company that does open source hardware.
And Make, it's been around for a couple of years now, and one of my jobs is to catalog trends that are going on and what people are doing. And for the last couple of years, open source hardware is a term that's kind of comes in, comes out. But we think that maybe this year and the years going forward, it might be as interesting or as popular or as controversial, as you might see here, as open source software. So we wanted to start out with a quote. This is from Richard Stallman from 1999, so 10 years ago. And the quote is, "I see no social imperative for free hardware designs like the imperative for free software." So, you know, 10 years ago almost, there probably wasn't a need for the licensing in the same way, or people weren't sharing
schematics. This quote is specifically him responding to people asking, well, aren't you going to make a hardware GPL instead of a very software-based license? And he said, you know, it doesn't seem to make much sense to do this, but I think in the last 8 years, we've seen a lot of really interesting things happen with hardware. Neil Gershenfeld wrote, you know, Fab Lab about the Fab Lab revolution, the idea that people will have desktop fabbers, and you know, if people saw the RepRap machine, which is a desktop fabber that's being worked on right now at the University of Bath. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, hardware has gotten cheaper and cheaper, where to the point that embedded Linux isn't unusual anymore. You know, for example, the WRT54GL has Linux running inside a router. Having desktop fabbers, having laser cutters drop in price from $20,000 down to now you can get one for $5,000. Still a lot, but it's the beginning.
Yeah, like I have one in the living room. There's a real laser cutter, and you know, you can do also. Well, sometimes you put food in it because it's funny, and you can etch food and stuff. But that's not the serious use for it. But like, it's starting to get to the point where this isn't crazy or unheard of. How many people would build or buy a RepRap, a 3D printer, if it were available like right now
for like $1,000?
$1,000. So yeah,
it's like you could like download, instead of downloading software, you would download, you know, the 3D files, and you'd press go and you'd print out, you know, any shape you wanted as long as it fit inside the box. So I think that's, you know, it's just a start. Of course, this is not, we're not ready to print out cars or, you know, televisions yet, but I think, you know, we're getting there.
Yeah.
So it's exciting.
So the question is, well, what is open source hardware? And so for the last year, we've kind of built articles and presentations and workshops and everything around, well, what is it? It's evolved. And so we have a definition right now. We think it's similar to what open source software is, but it's, and you can elaborate a little bit on this, it goes to layers. It's not just like, oh, well, everything's open. There's actually individual layers of the hardware that can be open or might not be quite as open.
Yeah.
And it's just, here's everything.
Like software, most people who write software are familiar, there's usually just code, and then you compile the code, you have a binary, and so it's pretty straightforward that the code itself, which is protected under copyright, is can be open source because you have the copyright protection. Well, with hardware, there's many layers of what can be open sourced and different legal aspects for each layer. Some are copyrightable, some are not, some are patentable. You know, there's different rules about you know, what protects each layer. So I think it's a little more complicated than software, but easily broken down into pieces.
And some of the software licenses do extend into the hardware. So there's some things that aren't a surprise, but then there are some new things where it's like, well, you know, what exactly is a schematic? Like, where does that fall in?
How do you protect a circuit board layout? What is that, a patent or is that a copyright? Well, it's an image, but it's not really. It's a description. So it's all, like, as we'll discuss later, it's all extremely new, and licenses are still being worked on as we're speaking.
So we broke it down to six layers. Seven would have sounded cooler, but
we could have a burrito hardware. But it's actually six layers.
Yeah, and the diagram would look better, but we've got six right now. Maybe next year it'll be a slightly different presentation with the seven, but right now we have six. Okay. So the first one we have is the mechanical and hardware diagram. So these are the actual enclosures and subsystems and some of the actual files
that
you would
use. Gears and rods and enclosures and, you know, where do you drill this part and how is, you know, how is this formed on this metal machine. So these are very, there's usually, you know, no electronics or software involved in this. It's just like a mechanical file, usually a DXF file or DWG files. You know, AutoCAD will create these sort of files for you. Yeah. So, you know, that's, you know, the first layer. It's very physical.
And as far as the file formats go, like, we'll use Illustrator files or we'll use DXF inside CorelDRAW to cut out two-dimensional parts. And those are sent around, and they're proprietary formats, I guess, but they're...
You can use PostScript, too.
Everything can read them, and pretty much at the end for, say, something that routes out things, as long as it has the format that has like vector art, it's okay.
It's like sending source code around in like a, you know, .doc file. It's a little weird, but, I mean, you can do it.
Yeah. And so this is one of the first examples of a... Well, this is one of the projects and one of the examples. This is from a RepRap, so this is the diagram that you actually would need if you were going to build one of the parts. You'd need the length, the width, the height, and
so that's
what it looks like.
A, you know, a 3D ray traced example, and then on the right there's the manufactured part, and then there's the, what the file would look like with, you know, the diagram, the dimensions and diagram, and usually there's descriptions of what material it has to be made out of.
Schematics and circuit diagrams. So this is what you spend a lot of your time publishing and putting up on the web, the I guess the DNA almost of or the skeleton of.
Yeah, so this is more you know, you take resistors and capacitors and you draw a, like, it's schematic. It's not real life sized, but it's the skeleton of what the project would be. So, for example, for the RepRap, it would be how do you wire up the motor controller, you know, to the motor controller board, and how is that laid out? So, we have an example coming up next, but this is basically just an image, just a drawing. And so, this is actually from the Chumbi, which is Bunny Huang's project, and these are the voltage regulators. So, you know, this shows what chips to use, what kind of diodes, and how you wire them up, and you know, you can build a Chumbi using just the schematics.
And pretty much everyone agrees to stick to the same symbols. I mean, this has been going on for
a long time. There's the standards for symbols, and there's only a couple different programs, but all of them can always, you can always print to a PDF. And that's all, you know, as long as it's high quality enough that you can read the text, that's good enough.
And which tools do you normally suggest to people to use?
There's an open source schematic capture program called Geta, and there, I think it's GScan. There's Eagle, there's PC123, there's OrCAD, there's Protel. There's lots of, unfortunately, a lot of them are very proprietary, and they're all really awful, as most CAD programs are. But you know, that's just how it is.
And as far as curves. As far as this particular example with the Chumbi, so if you want to do a project right now that might need a 3.3 volt regulator or 5, would you actually use this as, just to get farther, faster?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really good example. I mean, the thing is that most people do hardware design the same way software engineers write software. They just steal from other people. And so the nice thing here is it's completely okay. You know, if I had a project and I need a 3.3 volt buck converter, and I'm like, well, you know, I have an example in this book, but I want a really solid design, one that can go into manufacture. I know that they've done research and they've spec this chip to be able to supply the amount of current required. They've really done research on this is the cheapest inductor that can do the job well. I don't have to do that work, which can easily take days. I can just snag their design.
So it's lazy web for hardware. Yes. It's just like, oh, I can probably find this somewhere and just
absolutely
figure it in my project. Parts list. And this is one of the ones that we spend a lot of time on at Make, because it's probably one of the hardest things for people to actually get all these parts, where they're from, and it's very specific, and there's lots of different places you can get them from. So
it's like, let's, instead of like downloading a DLL or a library, imagine you actually have to order one from a store and wait a week, and maybe it's the wrong one because you mistyped something.
Yeah.
So this can be, it's frustrating sometimes if you're not used to how parts lists work, but it's necessary because each part usually is very specifically required, and if you make any substitutions, suddenly nothing works anymore.
And it doesn't,
blows up.
It doesn't work. And the other thing is, if you don't describe some of the parts, the specifications, like you might not have the right diode. You just need to say, like, here's what it needs to do. So you could, if you wanted to do a part substitution, you could.
Usually this is included as a text file with the schematic, but sometimes if it's a small schematic, they'll just literally write it underneath the image. They'll say, this is a, you know, LM741. DIP format, you know, and then maybe a note like, oh, you can also substitute a 358. You know, that's fine, too.
Okay. And this is one of your parts lists that you document, which is helpful when we write about stuff on Make. It's very, there's pictures of each one, which is kind of new. That's one of the things that we're starting to see is people are taking advantage of the web, and you can put photos, you can put photo notes. Your documentation sometimes has notes of the individual parts.
Yeah, so you can see, you know, the capacitors, and then at the bottom there's a chip, and then there's a description, and then the quantity. This is only a small part of the 500 pieces required for this project. And then after that, there's a part number, and then after that, it says Mauser, and Mauser is a common catalog distributor. So at the beginning, I say, all these parts, you can go to Mauser, type it into, you know, the order parts box, and it'll show up in your cart, and you can check out with, you know, give them a credit card and you're done. It shows up at your door a week later.
Yeah. And as far as what you're seeing, are you noticing that people are starting to put parts list up like this, or is it still?
There's a mix, but what's nice is that, you know, Mauser and Hope, I think maybe even DigiKey and Jameco, and now the startup Octopart, they're starting to do BOM tools, that's bill of materials tools. So it actually allows you to define a project, and then you actually send this file, and then you can upload it and automatically populate, so you have to type it in. So, you know, people are experimenting with ways of making this process faster because it is extremely tedious.
Yeah, with Octopart, it's almost like a parts playlist, like you would get, like you can this or a list file of here's what you need for this project, and you can go to their site and it'll pull up all the parts that you need, and you could potentially order it all in one shot, but that's still not quite.
I think it's in progress. The only problem is, of course, is that, you know, no one distributor tends to, you know, you rarely do you get all your parts from a distributor, so no matter what, it's always you have to buy from three different places. It's better than it used to be, because it used to be that you had a paper catalog and you'd have to go through thousands of pages to find it. Now at least you can do a web search, but it's still far from perfect.
So layout diagrams, these are the physical things that you could send to a fabrication facility to actually make the PCBs. And we have PCBs, and we'll show one.
We'll show one, a physical, you know, example one on the Elmo later. But basically, this is a piece of fiberglass, and they you basically send this file, and they will photoresist to create a copper image onto the fiberglass, and those are your connections. So if you open up your computer, it's that green thing, or if you open up your, you know, cell phone or MP3 player, it's usually a little, it's a circuit board, and you know, they cost very little when you make thousands. If you want to make one, it costs maybe $50, but they're all defined using the same format files called Gerber RS274X, which stands for something, I'm sure, and Exelon drill files, and that tells you where to drill the holes, where to put the copper. And luckily, this is an industry that's pretty much figured it out. It's very easy now. You can go to a website, upload a zip file, and a week later, it's at your doorstep, thanks to FedEx. So.
And the tools that most people use, again, this is like Eagle.
Yeah, it's actually the same programs that do schematic capture. You usually have a pair program that takes that schematic and helps you create a layout based on that schematic. So they range from free to $10,000 easily. for people who do very high-speed motherboard design because of the constraints required to make all the buses match up. And, you know, you have to make sure that you don't have RF problems. But you can get free software. There's, the Geta Suite. It's free and open source. And
so with the open source hardware projects, that the simpler ones that don't require, like, double-sided boards or whatever, people are putting up these, and you can actually do iron-on transfers at your own circuit boards at home if you wanted to.
For simple, you know, very beginner projects, what you can do is just you can print a PDF, and then you can do this sort of fun trick you learn in Mr. Wizard's World where you print it onto a wax paper, and then you can iron it onto a piece of copper you buy from Radio Shack, and then you put in some chemicals, and you etch it away, and voila, you've got your, you know, circuit made at home. So it is possible to do it at home, but, you know, once you get to more complicated stuff, you really need to send it out.
And right now, when you send out your boards, is it overseas? Is it in the U.S.?
There's tons of companies in China that want your business. There's tons of companies in the U.S. that want your business. Always trade-offs. I mean, there's easily thousands of manufacturers. There's dozens in the U.S. right now.
And will you generally try different ones?
Yeah, I have to try different ones. You know, each one has, you know, some have better quality in certain aspects. Some have faster turnaround. There's always trade-offs.
So here's one example of this is the Make open source MP3 player.
Yeah. So it's a little confusing, but you can see the red traces are the top of the circuit board, and the blue are the bottom, and the green are holes. And then you can see white markings. Those are silk screens. Those are written on there for assistance when you assemble this project. And you can see some parts outlines that help you just determine where to put the parts. And this is the final one. So you can flip back and forth, maybe.
Yeah, how it looks.
So you can see that's, you know, the completed circuit board.
We don't know the exact numbers, but we think we're outselling the Zune right now.
Yeah.
So we've sold tens of dozens of these. So
yeah.
We think we're okay. But if you do want to build an MP3 player or the start of something, we thought this would be a fun thing because, like, my grandparents built radios, and this is what
this is like the next, you know, build your own tube radio.
Yeah.
Build your own MP3 player.
People are doing fun things. Someone put it inside of a hat, and then they had RFID tags all over the place, so as they walked around, different songs would play.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we'll talk about some of the weird things that happen with open source hardware once it gets out there, because really what happens is you have no idea.
Yeah. So usually the schematic, the layout, and the parts list, they're actually three different things, and they're all related. You can distribute a board file without a schematic, and usually you can reverse engineer it, and you can take a schematic and turn it into a board file, but it's preferable, of course, that you distribute both at once. Sometimes people don't because, you know, they're paranoid or they want to do more revisions, but usually you get all of them in one package together, distribute together.
And the firmware, so I'm sure a lot of folks here have probably worked on firmware in some way, because that's the code part, the things that you can actually write to.
Now that we have embedded Linux, again, that's firmware. It's running on a chip. There's no hard drive involved. We had the OpenSpark people here, and they're working on OpenCore for a chip. So this is basically software or code that you compile onto or into a chip. Cores and firmware are actually very different. Cores describe a chip, hardware and firmware runs on that chip. But in this case, I tend to group it together because, you know, core hardware, sometimes people call them FPGAs, and those are they're not exactly like microcontrollers. But, you know, instead of dividing it, because few people have both a core design and a firmware design, usually it's one or the other. But this is like real software. I mean, this is like you type, you know, descriptions and variables and for loops, and then you hit go and then upload.
So which one of your projects has both?
I don't actually do any core design.
So you don't have to worry about that. You just have firmware, and then you have the software that controls it.
But people who do, you know, people in industry who do chip design, many, you know, for example, the iPods, they all have custom cores in them. You know, Apple went to some company, or maybe they did in-house, and they said, we need a chip that does MP3 decoding and does, you know, hard drive talking and does all this other stuff, and for the iPhone, they said, you know, also has to do, you know, all this phone stuff. And to cut costs, we put it in one chip, so they fab their own chip. And we're not quite at the point of people fabbing their own chips at home yet, but it is getting cheaper, and, you know, you can fab a chip for a couple $1,000s.
Yeah.
Get a prototype out.
than an example here. This is from an 8080.
Yep, this is from opencores.org, which is a really cool site. And what they do is it's a group of people, and they're all really into making cores for chips, many of them already in existence. For example, the 8080, and they have the 6502. So, you know, if you want to make, clones of old computers, you can actually just download this code onto an FPGA, and you're playing, you know, Commander Keen. So this is an 8080 ALU. So this is, just part of the accumulator. And this is describing to the chip how to move the registers around to create that part of the arithmetic logic unit. So it's basically just text.
So a lot of people that work on emulation projects would look at something like that?
Well, you can do that, but usually they both look at the same specification. I think this is for people, for example, cores such as the 8051, very old, very popular core. You know, for example, Cypress is a company that makes a USB chip. And, you know, this chip does all sorts of USB functions, and you can turn it into a client or a host. And instead of creating their new architecture, they just picked up an 8051 core, maybe off of open cores, dumped it in their chip, and now they've got the arithmetic logic unit and all the, you know, memory functionality of an 8051, which is familiar, and there's lots of compilers for that chip. And then they just add a couple extra registers that allow the compiler and, you know, the modifications of the compiler to let it handle the USB section of the chip. So it's really useful for industry because, you know, you can just toss a core in there and, like, boom, you're done.
Yeah, now you have USB stuff taken care of.
Yeah, and that's why you see a lot of phones with ARM cores in them, because that's also, you know, very inexpensive. It might even be free core that you can just toss into a chip very simply, and a lot of compilers target it, so it's a great core to use. Very powerful, too.
And we mentioned software before, so software and API, this is what everyone here is for. This is the actual software that you use to send information to and from and interact with the physical hardware?
Yeah, so this is interesting because it's actually not hardware, but I think it's important to add this in because, for example, the Open Graphics Project, they're doing this because anyone who's worked on drivers for Linux knows that the graphics driver problem is huge. It's like there's NVIDIA or some other companies will not release documentation on how to talk to their chipset. And, you know, I think that's awful. You can't have hardware and not explain how you talk to that hardware. And so I think it's important that if there are special drivers or APIs necessary to talk to your design, you should have that open, too. You should document that so it's easy to communicate with the hardware you designed, make it useful for the end user.
And for your projects, you have software that talks to the POV wheels.
So there's like software that like communicates. Sometimes there's some customization you want to use a computer because it's so great for displaying images. Hardware isn't usually very good at that. And you know, you plug it into your USB port or something. So I tend to open source the software so that people can see exactly how I communicate with the hardware.
Yeah, and one of the examples, probably hear the term Arduino. It's an open source physical computing device, and we'll show a really fun example in a moment, but this is how you write to it. You just download the IDE, and you can start sending information, start sending your little programs, and have things like LEDs blink or motors move.
This is actually an IDE that allows you to write firmware for this open source hardware, but they just made a really nice IDE, and they open sourced it. It's in Java, and it runs on every known operating system on Earth. So you can see you write C code in this IDE, and then there's a little arrow, and I think when you press that, that's the upload arrow or something.
Yeah, it sends it over.
Or you can download and, you know, play, stop, debug.
So each level can be open sourced in different ways, and then we get into, well, this layer isn't, but this layer is, and a couple examples that we have is, how many of you have this router and have, like, hacked out? Yeah, so, and you've probably hacked it, and now it's, like, a completely better router.
It calls your plans.
Yeah. and so the firmware is open sourced. It's GPL. So people can change what's on the router and then turn it into, I think there's like a million projects
You know, free websites just for downloading new firmware to upload to this device. But, for example, they have not open sourced the schematics or the board layout or the physical case. You know, that's just part of the deal.
Yeah.
You know, often a company will not open source the entire project, if they even open source anything.
So this is an open source hardware project. It just has some elements, and you're able to do some
some things with it.
Another one, the Roomba robot vacuum. A couple of years ago, they decided to have an open interface, and basically you can plug it. You can do serial communications, and the Roomba is just dumb. It just doesn't. You just send it information; it can do whatever. So people made, of course, the beer fetching Roomba and the Roomba that does teleconferencing. I think there was a geolocation one here. There's tons of projects that you could communicate with Bluetooth. You can pretty much control the robot in any way. And the reason they did this is they thought, well, people have these vacuums, and it's a locomotion platform that you spend all your time doing this with robotics. When you're finished, you don't feel like doing anything else. So we can just let you communicate with it via serial, and they have an open interface.
So they only opened the interface, but they didn't. They may have released schematics, or I'm not sure, but I don't think they released any other part of the project.
Yeah. So another one that's kind of open source. Ambient Orb, another information device. They don't show you how to make an orb from start to finish, but they do release the schematic if you wanted to build your own.
Yeah, the schematic and the parts list and also the other information about where to get the parts. It's not open sourced. It's still copyright owned by them.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a start. It's a beginning. They're releasing this information.
So how would you say this is different? Because we always hear, well, back in the day, there's an Apple IIe that gave you schematics, or car stereos used to.
Yeah, well, I think this is a very close analog of what used to happen when you bought a computer and it came with schematics or diagrams on how to repair it. This is different because this is actually not open source. You can't go out and actually, own or do stuff with this or modify it and sell it or add it into a different product. It's still owned by the company. So a lot of people say, like, well, isn't this really old stuff because companies always used to release their schematic? No. We're talking about more licensing. This is the difference between releasing the source code but saying you can't compile it or, you can't use it for other projects and saying this is open source, here's the code, it's GPL, go forth and do something cool.
Yeah. So with Ambient Orb, why do you think they released this?
I think they were, I think that... they're a bunch of geeks, and they probably thought it was cool to release the design and show people how it was done. It's a well-done design, but I don't know. I mean, like, maybe just some engineers managed to convince management that there would be no harm from this. I mean, the reason they probably could do it is because the Ambient Orb is a subscription service, so even if you built one, you can't really do anything because you'd have to subscribe to the radio service.
Same thing with the Chummy. The real value is using their website that you configure and get all these channels.
Yeah.
Bunny, when he was talking to us about the Chumby, he said one of the things that people wanted to do is the people who need to do experiments with rats, there's a rat cage computer that they need to build, and they want to use the Chumby because it's an LCD screen and it's a computer, and they can just kind of get all that development out of the way, and now they have a rat computer, which sounded cool. I didn't understand exactly at first. Rat computer, that's awesome.
Rats. Okay.
So this brings us to licensing, and there's still a lot of different things. There's a couple, the Tapper Open Hardware License, that's like ham radio guys.
Yep. They sell kits that, are ham radio keyers and filters and software-defined radio.
Yeah.
So they decided they wanted a license because it's very hard to apply, BSD and MIT and GPL and LGPL licenses to hardware. Like, what does it mean to release a source code with the binary? It's complicated. You get a circuit board. Do you have to have a URL on it, or do you have to have a CD with it? With the project, or what can you protect? What can't? So, especially with patents, because at the time the GPL didn't talk about patents, and you could patent hardware. And what if somebody patents a derivative work, and does that mean that you don't have permission to use your work? It gets messy trying to use existing licenses. So only in the last, as you can see, months, people have started to sketch up ideas for what would be a good license. So Chumby came up with the HDK license, and from talking to Bunny briefly, from what I could tell, they have patented certain parts of the design, and they... Yeah. Give permission to anybody using their... They give full permission to use their patents, and they will not sue them. And in exchange, by using their design, if you make any derivative works, you can patent those, but you have to also use the same license and release the patent for general use.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's using patent law instead of copyright law to create this viral effect of licensing. But, I mean, who knows? I mean, it says at the bottom this is likely to change in the next few months because they don't know yet.
Yeah, who knows? None of this has really been tested yet. Like, what do you use for all your stuff? You have Creative Commons online?
Yeah, it's a big mix. I mean, the software is GPL and the hardware is MIT. And then I just put a Creative Commons on the board layout and say, like, well, what does share alike mean? I have no idea. Just, like, we'll figure it out later.
Yeah, so what generally happens if someone wants to use something you've built? Do they email you?
Usually just ask. It just says, like, if you're not sure, just ask. I mean, it's all licensing is. It's all an honor system, really. I mean, some company could go and make this, and I would never hear about it. I would never open up the box. I would never know.
Yeah.
But most people play fair because, you know, it's part of the system.
Yeah, that's a physical thing, too, so eventually you'll see it. You'll be able to find that.
So this is the part that we hope at the end maybe folks have some questions. So the business model. So unlike software, the compiling is the hardest part with hardware.
I think what Sam was trying to say in that quote in the beginning is that, you know, I can send you a tar file and say, build this on your Linux machine or your Mac, and after you get your development environment set up, it's free. You can compile it as many times. That's very not true with hardware. To compile a hardware project costs hundreds of dollars, can be thousands of dollars, depending on, you know, how expensive the project is. And so it's harder than software, but that can also become, instead of a liability, it can become a pro, because now companies can come in and sell a service, and that service is the compiling service. For example, we'll show some examples of this, but you can release all the files and say, you are free to build this any way you want and do anything you want. But let's say, you know, you don't want to have to find somebody to mill out this part. Well, we'll sell you this part for like $10. And we make money because it costs us 50 cents in material and we have the machine, but for you it would cost $50 because it's a one-off.
And the reason why people might buy your kits is because you have scale. You buy so many parts,
right?
They can never get a resistor for like a couple pennies.
Right. Hardware scaled so fast, the cost of getting one circuit board made is basically the same as getting 1,000. So it makes sense, you know, and that's how manufacturing works. I mean, you set up the machine, you get it all prepped, and then you say go, and it stamps out as many as you want. So it's usually tooling costs and, you know, one-time setup costs. And so that's where companies like Chumbi and Arduino and Fab at Home and all these other ones, that's where they make their margin.
Yeah. And a couple examples that are happening right now are the Arduino kits, and we'll have an example of what folks are doing with it in a bit. Those are assembled, so you buy them assembled, so they're making their money.
It's a finished product.
Yeah, you get it, you plug it into via USB, you download the software, and now you're ready to go. But if you wanted to, you could get your own circuit board and assemble your own kits, and people are starting to do different versions of Arduinos that are that are more tuned for specific types of projects. Chumbi, they're going to sell it online. You're just going to go online and order one. It's going to show up at your door. Fab at Home, they do have kits right now that they sell between $400 and $500, and then finished fabbers for like $3,000.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not exactly clear. It looked like the site was still under construction, but the idea is that you could build this 3D fabber, desktop fabber yourself. But if you want like a kickstart, you can get all the really hard to get parts shipped to you by this company that has a laser cutter and can cut them out for cheap, and then you just have to bolt it together. And you still have to do a lot of work, but you know, you've cut your costs and time considerably. So you can get right to the fun part of playing with the machine.
Yeah, and the Daisy MP3 player, that's another neat example of we're funding someone who wants to do this for a living. When we put out the kit, someone said in the comments on Make, they're like, well, I really hope that you're paying this hardware designer because it's open source. You must have just stole it and made your own version, your own Make version. We said, no, he's actually getting paid for these kits. So he's able to scale and make enough kits. So not only can he keep his business going, but now we can, you know, sell them and other people can start building. So couple of projects and examples. This is the RepRap on the left-hand side, and that's the Fab at Home. Definitely a couple different directions each project is going, but the end result is hopefully that these fabbers can even fab copies of themselves or parts of themselves.
So you can see the one on your right has these acrylic cutout parts, and you know, you snap them together, and then there's some bolts, and then there's a circuit board kind of hidden there in the corner. And then the one on the left is a RepRap, and the idea is that it's self-replicating. So all those white plastic parts are parts that the machine can print. So all you have to do is buy some, it looks like rods from Home Depot or something, and some wire, and you know, you find another guy with a rep wrap or girl, and you tell them to please print out this set of parts. You do, and then you can build your own out of those parts. So it's self-perpetuating.
Yeah.
With, you know, you also need to buy a motor.
And I've heard some of the people from RepRap talk at different conferences, and what they want to do is have like a giant RepRap party where there'd be a couple there.
Yeah.
And like at the end of the night, there'd be 50. And then there'd be another one, there'd be 50. And they'd take over the world Grey Goose type problem. But until then, yeah, it would be fine. This is the Arduino. The one on the left is the one that comes straight from the folks who developed it. And then the one on the right is a bare bones Arduino, which is a slight variation.
Right. So this was, I think, the one on the left is got this, you know, USB chip on it, and it's about $35 and, you know, made in Italy. But then this professor in Rhode Island School of Design, I can't remember his name, but he needed a lot of them. They needed to be a lot cheaper because he needed to give one to every one of his students, and then, of course, their students, then he has to give them another one when they break it. And so he designed his own that cut out half of the parts because he's like, well, they don't really need these parts, and was able to develop them, and actually became very popular because everyone else was like, I want one for half price, too. And the Arduino group thinks this is great because they just want as many people to get their hands on this hardware as possible. So this is how, you know, versions and forking work with hardware. The chip that you see, the long IC in the middle, is the same, runs the same firmware. It's just a different physical layout.
And for some of the learning projects, right away people start to do breadboarding so they can plug in little components and learn right away. So someone made one where it just snaps on top.
So there's like two companies that have two different revisions of these boards that plug on top, and because the schematics and the design were open source, it was very easy to create these add-ons.
Yeah. And, of course, what would you do with all this information that you can share, with the sensor information that people are publishing? Well, the project that I like to point to is Botanicals, and this makes plants able to talk. And call you when they get mad and they need water.
So you can see, you can see that there's a bunch of sensors connected to an Arduino. And then there's a display, probably an LCD display, and then an XB, and that's a
wireless sensor.
What are they called? There's Zigbee. It's a new Zigbee board, and somebody released a method to plug that into the Arduino, and they open sourced it. Connect to an export, that's Ethernet. And there's asterisks, and there's all sorts of, like, it's like a big chunk of open source.
Here's a quick video.
Hi, my name is Kate. This is Rob.
Hi.
And we're here to tell you about Botanicals. And Botanicals is a system that allows plants to call people via telephone to express their needs.
So we're going to show you how the system works. We have a demonstration set up. This plant is an ivy plant with very wet soil, and it has moisture probes inserted into the soil. So the plant's very happy, doesn't need to make a telephone call right now, but as its soil dries out, it'll reach a point where it needs water, and it'll want to make a call to do that. For demonstration purposes, we don't want to wait for that plant to dry out, so we have another ivy plant, same kind of plant, same kind of soil, except the soil is entirely dry. And by moving the moisture probes from the wet soil over into the dry soil, the Botanicals system will trigger a telephone call, and here that is. It's for you.
Hi, this is the ivy. I'm desperately in need of a drink. Do you think you could find it in your heart to maybe water me a little?
So basically, once you respond to a plant's need, it can give you different kinds of feedback. For instance, if you water it but not quite enough, it'll call and let you know. If you water it but too much and there's, you know, lots of water gathering in the saucer, it'll call and ask you to maybe dump some of it out. In this instance, we're going to move this back to that very nice moist soil, and it's going to call us, and we'll see what it says.
Ooh, thank you for watering me. That felt like a fresh spring rain.
Okay. So, as with any good relationship,
so that's probably someone's nightmare. On a more serious note, the Open Prosthetics Project is an example of more of the CAD and 3D designs,
yep.
And it's not really any software. It's just the designs for prosthetics, which if you're in developing nations or if you're in places where
Maybe you just want like cheap prosthetics. You want an experiment because there's, you know, what is on the market isn't good enough for you or doesn't fit your needs.
And if you check out the site, I think it's openprosthetics.org, you'll see all sorts of modifications of existing things. Like there's a Spider-Man toy that apparently works great. If you've lost your hand, it has a hook on it and it has a string, so you can like really go far and grab stuff. So there's and it starts conversations about, well, we can make one like this, and here's how we would do it, and here's the schematic.
So I think this is, so you can see this is, you know, clearly made from a 3D description file, and I think this is EDM. I think this is 3D printed, but with metal, using actually a moving process. But it's hard to tell from the photo.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a one-off. I don't think this is a manufactured part. So they're experimenting using these fabric technologies to create prototypes that they experiment with, and there's, you can see, you know, five photos of how this project moved, and they changed where the notches, and they changed where the bolts are, and you know how the grippers work, trying to figure out, you know, in this rapid prototyping style, what is the best design.
So a potential project that could be printed out locally after more revisions. You just download the latest one and say, okay, no.
So you can play with it and then, you know, make it metal.
And for the rest of the projects we have, they're yours, so we can actually kind of dig into these. So one of the projects that you released, I think it was last year, was Minty Boost.
Yep.
And that is a USB charger that can charge just about anything that gets its power from USB, which is probably all
so it's just like, it's just a, you know, a fun project for learning how to solder. And what's neat is, you know, it's actually cheaper and better than most products on the market right now. And, you know, you have to put some of the work into it, unfortunately. But what's neat is some people have made modifications to, and they've discovered on their own what it's good for. So next slide shows a lot of bicyclists that go on like two or three-day mountain bike or road bike tours. They want to have GPS devices, but those GPS, the Garmin GPSs, don't last more than 6 hours. So what they do is they create battery packs using a Minty Boost, and this person actually designed a quick-release mount so that they can mount onto their handlebar, and they can keep adding, you know, every day they put in a couple AA's, and they're good to go for the next day of the trip.
Yeah, one of the things that we see people do with this particular project is they don't want to use 9-volt batteries because it's 9-volt and everything they need is 5-volt, so you lose power somewhere, and 9-volts aren't rechargeable. So they're making their own battery packs that you can...
Yeah, so for all sorts of different projects.
Yeah, and you can plug those into the wall and with a recharger. And another example is a bike light. This is a this is on my bike, and my LED needed 3.3 volts. So because it was documented, because I could find the spec sheet, you just put a wire on a different pin, and now it's delivering 3.3
volts. Yep, so you can run a 1-watt LED off of it.
Yeah, so almost it could be considered like a universal power supply for low power gadgets or whatever. This is your SpokePov project. So when did you start working on this one?
So this is 3 years of, it's going to be the coolest Burning Man project ever. And then 3 years later, I actually got it working. So it's a display for bicycle wheels. Mm-hmm. So it's a, you know, an old project, but it's been revised a lot. And you can see you can put animations in. So as you're biking, you can see like this Pac-Man and this ghost. And if, like, you're tripping or something, it's, like, messes you up, and I don't know. But so you can upload images and customize this. So one person put a rat running in his bike wheels. So
yeah, and there's Super Mario.
There's some sort of weird stuff.
And then, of course, someone put on a high-powered, dangerous robot.
He did a lot of mods. So he took the hardware, the firmware, and the software, modified all of them so that this his robot, I guess it's got a spinning razor blade. I guess that's what people's robots do. He wanted to display some sort of warning message to the robot he was about to chop into bits. So he, you know, used the SpokePov design to, you know, mount it on. Of course, you have to make modifications because this thing is going way faster than a bike wheel. It's like, I think he actually put an RPM meter on it and calculated it was going 3,000 RPM. It's actually pretty useful because he had no other way of calculating that. But that's a good modification of open hardware.
And this is the MiniPod, which is kind of a smaller version of the SpokePov.
Yeah, it's like a little miniature precision vision toy. It's, you know, very cheap for people who are just beginning learning how to program chips.
And you sell all these, just to make it clear, because we were talking about business models, this is what you sell every day.
Yeah, I sell these for money. People send me money in exchange for a box.
Gotcha.
So revolutionary.
So it's not like Google Ads. It's not like Google Ads.
There's actually no Google Ads.
There's no Google Ads.
None involved, odd.
You just sell them. And so this one, a little bit different. It's handheld, so you can
This is Arseny, our friend, using it to try to hail a cab in the Bowery in New York. I don't think he succeeded. But he went with technology.
Yeah, and then we had an article in Make, and I have the glasses here. So the inventor of the TV Be Gone, Mitch Altman, thought it'd be neat to take the persistence of vision project, and I guess he worked on brainwaves like back in the 70s. Yeah, if we could switch to the Elmo real quick. He worked on brainwave machines in the 70s.
So you can see this part here is the same part as this, and just modified. He added some different chips on it, added a headphone jack, and put two of the LEDs with some paper. The paper is necessary for effect, so that when you turn it on, it blinks the LEDs in a certain pattern that promotes some sort of brain wave activity. Some of our friends say they it's a great hit at parties because like people just sit there and stare at it, and you can hear it. It's going to be really loud.
Yeah, so this is going to probably mess everyone's brain up. So if you can switch to the audio that's on the Elmo.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... Come out of it! Come out of it! there's a 15-minute long program. It's actually very popular. A lot of people apparently want to build these brainwave machines.
It's like that scene in Superman, I think. Now everyone has superpowers, and I lost mine or something.
Yeah.
So he was able to quickly build this and release it, and it's a project that we have up on Make, because he didn't have to build all the rest of the pieces.
Right. All he said is all you have to do is buy these two parts at Radio Shack and then use this hardware kit that is already in existence, change the firmware, and it's a completely different project.
And then the project that I'd say this is where you make a significant amount of your income as far as your open source hardware business, it's the ZoxBox.
Yes, this is a synthesizer that's a clone of a TB-303. So the TB-303 actually did have some patents, but since it's from the 80s, those patents have expired. So it's completely fine for me to reuse the schematic. I redrew it, rewrote all the firmware, and designed a near-perfect clone with some modifications. I added MIDI. MIDI didn't exist at the time, but most musicians demand it now, so some additions, and put it in a different box, and it's completely open source. So, 99% of people they just build it, they make their music, they're happy, but 1% actually make major modifications to the firmware, adding capabilities. This fellow, BC Box, created, it might not be easy to tell, but there's actually an extra circuit board on top of the original one. You can see that the top half is a separate circuit board. So we spent 3 months designing a completely new, plug-in that attaches on top and adds like more oscillators and different filters. And he's actually selling this as a service. So you can buy the kit for me, and then if you want his crazy ultra mega mod, you pay him, $450, and he'll add his version onto it.
So you have a ZoxBox over here?
Yes, I can show an example.
You can switch to the Elmo again.
So, and then audio also for this. This is sort of random mode. But it's just sort of like, So it's just like a fun toy. And, if you wanted to buy the original TB-303 right now, I think on eBay they're going for something like $1,200 minimum to buy one. But you can build it for $300. And you can like add all these modifications, and it comes with MIDI.
Will your open source version surpass the sales of the original one at some point?
I think the original sold about 10,000, so not yet. But it's within reason.
There'll be more clones one day, maybe, than the original.
Yeah, eventually there will probably, if I can continue making them, there will soon be more in circulation that are clones than are originals, because unfortunately the originals have certain value, and so people don't take them out of the box and use them.
Yeah.
Once they've established that they're worth $2,000, which is a little bit unfortunate.
We can switch back to the projector, the computer.
Oops. Oh, no.
Should be back to the computer slide. So we have one project that's an open source hardware project, but it's an open source hardware project because you can't sell it, no one can sell it, and we're not even supposed to have it. So this is,
So this is these are three examples with the new Ultra Black Ops circuit board design that's all black with white text. This is the original.
We'll show it on the Elmo in just a second.
So this is a cell phone jammer, and it's open source. And what's nice about it is it's designed in a way that you can actually jam any frequency. You connect to it via USB, and then you type in to the terminal what frequencies you want it to jam. There's a phase lock loop in it. It will, you know, spend a minute tuning itself and then say, okay, boom, now I'm jamming Wi-Fi, or now I'm jamming Bluetooth, or now I'm jamming GPS, or PCS, or GPRS, or GSM, you know, all these different frequencies. So, you know, the firmware is available. So people have actually been modifying this and trying to do different stuff with it. There's because I can't sell it, I don't really offer much support, but there's, you know, step-by-step instructions on where to buy the parts, how to get this fabricated. This costs maybe $50 to make, and then the rest of the parts cost another $100, what tools to use. And there's a community of people on the forums that you know, have built, I think probably about 20 have been built so far in the last, it's been 6 months since the project was released. And they, you know, help each other. And because, you know, this, again, hardware scales, buying 100 of these costs about the same as buying two, so they'll do group buys. You know, one guy will spend the money to buy 100 circuit boards. One person will spend the money to program all the chips, and then they'll exchange amongst each other on the forum, show this information, and, you know, make modifications. Or, you know, some people are trying to boost the power because 10 feet is enough for them. They want, you know, 30 feet. So they're doing research about what parts to modify, how to change the layouts, and re-releasing them for these modifications.
And you just did this because you don't like cell phones?
Yes.
Okay. So on the Elmo, if we can switch to that, could you show it?
And
we'll open it up for questions and answers in a bit, but I wanted you to turn off everyone's Wi-Fi if you could.
Oh, okay.
No more Twitter.
Yeah, that was a promise of us. Can we switch to the overhead thingy? Oh, thank you. So there you go. And this is this one where I talked about circuit board. Let's see if I can get a good picture.
You can zoom in too if you want.
Zoom in. So you can see all of the chips and the traces. It's unfortunately it's a black solder mask. It's hard to see the actual traces. This is one, but all the parts and on, you know, the flip side even more. There's a phase lock loop. This is a particularly advanced project. Most you know, projects I release aren't this bad. And then, you know, here's where the battery goes. So you can use an iPod battery, and this is the case. And then you assemble it. Three parts just to protect it, and then there's the button. You turn on the button. Let's see, what will this jam? Cell phone. So now it's going to jam Wi-Fi. I actually don't have Wi-Fi antennas on here, so it won't work that well, but we'll see if anyone says, God damn it, I didn't save my file in time.
Yeah. So internet cafes.
Really, if you're like everyone's sitting there and they're not buying anything, but you also can't get a seat.
Public transportation with cell phones.
Wireless. Apple stores. Apple keynotes.
The wireless.
What the hell are you thinking?
Wireless controllers with the Xbox.
Yeah.
And
so this is supported
Wing.
By iBeam. I have to mention that because it was an open source residency that I had, and they wanted to support hardware. So they actually, because I can't make money on this, I can't sell them. I can't even sell circuit boards. They supported me on this project because for some sick reason they really wanted me to design.
But it was for sale at an art auction, because if you ever want to do a project like this, it's an art project, and get away with it.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
So we have a few minutes for questions, and we hope some folks say that maybe there's no money in this, or there is money in this. So just hop up to the microphone, and we'll get through these as fast as we can.
Hi. Hey. It works. The Daisy MP3 player, does it support Ogg Vorbis?
No, not yet.
And it can. There's one chip that you have to swap out. It's the VS1001. And if you just change it to like the VS1003, which I believe is PIN compatible, it will suddenly become an open source Ogg Vorbis player. And because, you know, he made it all open source, it's very easy to do that. I think you have to change some of the firmware to look for .ogg instead of .mp3, of course. Or you can just rename all your files to .mp3. And yeah, it'll suddenly become an Ogg Vorbis player. Now try doing that with your iPhone.
Cool.
Yeah.
Off?
Turn it off.
No.
Okay. So yeah, the Wi-Fi jamming demonstration is over.
Sorry.
The next version we're going to try to do is going to have an AVR chip, because people seem to like that one more, and of course having Ogg Vorbis is a good thing. We'd like it to be completely as open as possible. And anyone else with questions? We have exactly a minute and a half left. And if not, we're getting off these.
What would be really nice is to have the component landing pads, the patterns for that, widely available. I noticed that SparkFun Electronics is now doing it for the stuff that they ship. But it would be nice if there was like some industry-wide effort to get everybody to include these, you know, online.
Yeah, absolutely. But very few companies will do that just yet. Just like very few companies release their software open source. It's only, again, like the licenses have only come into existence maybe 2-3 months ago, and they're version 0.1. So, you know, when you say that you want that, that helps. And hopefully companies will start doing that because they see that the consumers want it.
Just a quick question on the patenting issue. These devices that you're patenting, and then there's sort of this open policy, we won't sue you kind of patent policy. Is the reason to take out the patent to prevent someone else who is evil from taking out a patent on that same design?
Yeah, I think with, I know that Open Prosthetics is a little concerned about this. So the problem would be with, for example, Chumby or Open Prosthetics is Open Prosthetics could design a very revolutionary kind of hook. And they would open source it, but then somebody could make a derivative work and patent it, and then no more, that fork would be closed.
Uh-huh.
So the idea is, can they design or use a license? Again, I'm not a patent or law geek, so this is all just what I've observed. So the idea is that they would create a viral license that would release all patents that are derived. So it's like copyleft, where you take the copyright and then say, because I have this copyright, I have permission to, or I have the right to require these require a viral license, but with patents, so there's a $10,000 fee for this.
Right.
So.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, if that's it, all the URLs are up online on the Make website. Just type open source hardware, and we'll see what happens a year from now. We're kind of bringing this presentation around, and we're talking about maybe a foundation one day, or you know, a variety of like prizes or something, where you would get microfinancing to do some of these things. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen yet, but there seems to be, you know, look at OSCON this year with the amount of hardware sessions.
So like 5 or 6 talks, or Spark and RepRap and Open Graphics and.
Yeah, software is wanting to talk to hardware more and more, so we think something's going to happen with that. So with that,
yep.
That's it. Thank you.
Cheers. Can I turn it back on?
Thanks, guys. Much appreciated. That was excellent.